Okay, then. Good morning. It is May 16th, 2023. I'm Kevin Griffin, and this is our little drop-in Zoom group. And so everybody is welcome. Thank you for coming. we're going to meditate for about 20 minutes after we get through admitting people. And then I'll talk for a while, and we'll wrap up around 11. Sometimes we run a little late if we're having fun. Not that we stop one time when we're not having fun, but just, well, anyway, let's not make it complicated. let's see, do I have any commentary where we've, for those of us who are fans of a certain basketball team, we're in the acceptance phase, moving beyond, and the everything is impermanent and all that, which is good, you know, because one of the things I've noticed is that as soon as you win a championship, you're faced with the problem that there's going to be a season next year that you have to face. So you can just never win. It's a lot like dukkha. Like, it's a lot like craving, you know. It's like you get the thing you want and then you want some more. So the key apparently is to let go. So we'll work on that. Keep trying to let go. See, even basketball is dharma. You can apply this to other, you know, things in your life. Just replace basketball with, you know, marriage or something like that. All right, folks. Looks like the waiting room has quieted down. Let's do some sitting. I guess I was upstairs Friday night, so I have to get all set up here in the basement. Okay. As warm as it is, it's always chilly in this basement, which can be good when it's really warm. But on the other hand, oh, here's one more person in the waiting room. Let's let them in and then we'll meditate. All right, because it's hard to let people in when your eyes are closed. Which, if you ever happen to peek, you'll notice that I peek several times during the sitting to make sure there's nobody stuck in the waiting room. So, here's Mary Ellen. Sorry. We can't get started until the late people show up. So we're going to, you know, we can all have a resentment about the late people. sorry. Now I'm already choking. God. Excuse me, I'm preparing a cough drop. I have a persistent throat itch these days. And so, oh, man. Okay. Sitting back, settling into your posture. My cough drop is giving me a lisp, so forgive me. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. And just let the body become still. Just feel the body, how you're holding it, your posture, balance. Are you tipping one way or another? And then letting the body soften and settle. Relaxing the jaw, releasing the shoulders. And feeling the breath going into the belly so that the tension is released there as well. So each time we meditate, we have to make this transition into stillness. And we often are carrying movement, either physical, mental, emotional, so that it can feel as if we are still moving forward, or that there's still a flow happening even as we try to settle. And we can't force that to stop. So we start just by feeling that, feeling the body and mind as moving energy, glowing energy. In the midst of that, feeling the breath, which is always moving, even when the body is very still. But the gentle rhythm of the breath can help us to become more grounded and settled. The Buddha tells us that if we sustain mindfulness of the breath, that the body will naturally become calm. And again, we don't force that or try to make that happen. We just do the simple practice of mindful breathing and give it the space to do its magic. Even in the first few minutes of a sitting, a lot can be revealed. Are we carrying some strong emotion with us? Is there a mood that is enveloping us? Or have we been obsessing with some thought or some plan or resentment or fear, anxiety? Or on the other hand, are we already somewhat relaxed? Is there not a lot of stress right now? We're just sitting down to meditate, taking away any externals, can reveal things like this. And it's not that we need to do anything special, just to see clearly and to bring an attitude of mindful acceptance. Of kindness, of gentle holding. And again, breathing with these experiences, whatever they are. The movement of mind is a natural process, not something to judge or to fight with, but again, simply to be aware, and then to gently come back to the present moment, to the breath, to the body. If there are particular persistent thoughts, it can be helpful just to notice those, categorize those, to see what the patterns of mind are that appear for you. It can be quite revealing, not to turn our practice into psychotherapy, but just to understand ourselves, to see where stress arises, or grasping and aversion are particularly triggered. Okay. Well, again, greetings. I've been reading some from my workbook, so-called workbook, Buddhism and 12 Steps workbook. Kind of a just a compilation of things that I teach. I actually found an old document that was probably a basis for a lot of it. But I thought I might just pick up with from something I was talking about during the guided meditation. The idea of sort of catching the themes that are really carrying you away in your meditation. We typically, I think that, we have a large focus in meditation on the letting go part and just being with the breath. And it is invaluable to become more settled and concentrated. And there's that really opens up a lot of potential for insight and just peace and serenity. But I think especially in daily practice, as opposed to sort of retreats where you have more of an opportunity to develop concentration, in our daily practice, I think there's much more of a tendency to spend a lot of our period of meditation sort of spacing out or thinking or lost in some kind of mental activity, mental formations. And, if we take an attitude that, these are just obstructions to my practice, I need to get rid of this stuff in order to really practice. If we see it all, so that then we're wasting then an opportunity in a way, right? So, you have the idea that I think Thich Nhat Hanh uses this as well as Chogyam Trungpa, the idea of manure, thinking of our what shows up in our meditation as the fertilizer, so if we, rather than discarding that as garbage or sewage, we rather inquire a little bit. And this has to be done very carefully, but and really inquiring might not even be the right word. I think observing, acknowledging, seeing clearly what's appearing in the mind. This can then be useful for us, that in multiple ways. So on the purely sort of cognitive and sort of verbal level, we can just see, what is it that I'm particularly, what am I thinking about? So that's the most basic question. What's this thought about? And then, that question, about, then can have layers, right? Because we know, there can be a topic that something is about, but you can then realize as well that, why am I caught up in this topic? So then it becomes the about becomes the underlying theme and cause, right? So a simple thing like, you find yourself repeatedly thinking about a coming event. And you could say, oh, well, I'm thinking about that coming event repeatedly. But of course, what that's about might be some anxiety about the coming event, right? You're going to see some people, or you're going to have a role in a social situation, or, you know, whatever it is, right? And so you realize, oh, this isn't about the coming event. It's about fear about that event. Okay, let it go. Come back to the breath, right? You've just sort of seen that. Not like, okay, let's keep going. But you can keep going if you're careful. If you do this, and this is where we have to be very careful that we don't, as I sort of said in the guided meditation, that we don't turn our meditation into therapy. The idea of inquiry is more like asking a question and then letting go and seeing if, you know, something comes back. It's sort of, yeah, you know, does some intuitive understanding or answer, if you will, arise out of that? Because the about then, oh, about the fear about this coming event, we can then easily ask the next question, like, well, what is the underlying fear, right? And then it stops being about the coming event or the particulars of the situation, and then you start to see into your own deeper psychological patterns, right? And you're like, oh, right. Like, I have this anxiety about my, you know, that's, you know, how people are going to perceive me. So here we get the opportunity to look on multiple levels. So now we're looking at the psychological personal level, which is my story that's connected to my history. And okay, good. And that's kind of the therapy line, which obviously has value. But then we can also see, oh, there's this other impersonal side of it, what we'd call the Dharma lens of it, which is just human fear, right? Ajahn Amaro I don't know if he still quotes this, probably one of his favorite things to quote, like a study that showed that people were more afraid of public speaking than they were of dying. And so his conclusion was, people are more afraid of ego death than physical death. You know, and so, yeah, we're stepping out then of this personal thing of, oh, my story and the people that I'm going to see and, you know, all that, into, oh, there's this fear of the ego being destroyed, of being, or being revealed or being humiliated. And that, you know, that sense of self, of a stable and, you know, something with sort of dignity and status and all that, that if that's threatened, that's a terrible fear, that's, and then we see how we are attached, right? And so here we see the clinging, right? And if you know understand the Four Noble Truths, so the second noble truth says there are three causes to suffering. Oh, somebody's just arriving late. Let's let them in, Monica. There are three causes to suffering. There's sensual desire, which we're all kind of familiar with. That's very obvious. Okay. And that's like for addicts, of course, that's kind of the core problem, at least the starting problem. But then there's this desire to be, is the language of the text. But what that's talking about is the desire to have this protected sense of self. This solid sense of being someone who is in control and safe and you know, and right, we're not wrong, we're right. You know, all the things that we protect around self. So coming back to where I started with this, all of this can be revealed in our meditation. And this is why it's called insight meditation, right? It's not just, oh, repeat your mantra or just pay attention to your breath and get peaceful for 20 minutes. It's, can you come to understand yourself and then further come to understand the Dharma in a way that's very freeing? Because once we see this, it's not that, oh, I got it now. Okay, I'm not attached to self. Great. But it gives us some perspective. So just like, you know, Monica and I were talking about impermanence before. It's like just, it's not that, oh, I see that I'm clinging to ego, so I'll just stop clinging to ego. But we can see, oh, yeah, what's going on in my mind? It's okay. You know, I don't have to get into a battle with what's going on in my mind. What's going on in my mind is not only okay, it's just it's natural. It's just this human tendency that the Buddha was pointing to. And that then, you know, one of my sort of central premises over the last few years about the value of insight is that when we understand things, when we aren't confused, that is a tremendous part of the process of moving towards freedom. As a you know, if we're talking about Buddhists, it doesn't even have to be Buddhist, but inner freedom. And so this kind of points to the second arrow teaching, right? Which I know many of you are familiar with, the idea that there is suffering that happens in our lives. There is physical pain, mental pain, emotional pain, spiritual pain. And that's somewhat unavoidable. I mean, we're kind of like what we're trying to navigate in our lives is to avoid that. But it you know, to some extent, it's going to come to each of us, some kind of pain in our lives. But that then there's a secondary pain, which is the mental reaction to that pain, which is typically a fight, a conflict, not wanting. I can't handle it. Don't want it. Got to get rid of it. And this, according to the Buddha, kind of doubles the pain. It's this secondary thing that expands on the suffering rather than contracting it. And that when we can let go of that piece, when we can see, oh, what's going on? Yeah, it's okay. I don't have to be. It's unpleasant. You know, this fear of this upcoming event, you know, that fictional event I've created. It's unpleasant, but it's natural. It's human. I see that myself. And so I don't have to pile on to it. And then, yeah, so putting this in terms of kind of 12-step work, this is what I call meditative inventory, right? This is, it's not the same thing as the 12-step inventory, but it's a kind of like that, right? It's what I would call sort of like a Buddhist approach to inventory. It's like looking inquiry into ourselves and seeing the self part of it, the ego part of it, the individuality of it, seeing the Dharma part of it, the impersonal part of it, and just understanding further. Then, yes, there is more we can do, right? We can become less attached. We can become less identified. We can actually start to weaken these natural tendencies so that the first arrow even starts to lose some of its power. This is, you know, where we're really moving towards, right? Where we just don't even take the self very seriously, you know, where, you know, things arise and they're seen clearly as they arise, and that just in the seeing, there's a letting go. And so this is what's depicted in the suttas as Mara that is sometimes called the tempter, kind of the devil, but we really see Mara as our ego, essentially. And Mara tries to attack the Buddha. So Mara is anthropomorphized in the suttas into this being. I don't know if it's an anthro being, but it's some kind of a being that comes to attack the Buddha. But the Buddha invariably sees Mara and actually says, "I see you, Mara." And in that moment, Mara then just slinks away. And so what's being depicted there is the level of clarity where those underlying tendencies of ego in this particular case, grasping and aversion, and can't take hold because they're seen so clearly. Now, this is an ideal, but it's one that, and again, many of you have been on retreats where you've had experiences like this. You may not have recognized them at the moment, but I know you can reflect on them and realize, oh yeah, there were times when I was sitting and like something would appear in my mind, but it was like, you know, you almost laugh at it. Like, oh, you're not going to get me. Like, it's so familiar. Right? Just becomes so familiar. This is, you know, Joseph Goldstein uses this exercise, I don't know if it's an exercise, but approach to working with judgments. You know, a very common problem on meditation retreats, people come into a teacher interview and say, you know, I'm just so full of judgments, I'm judging everything. And Joseph will tell people, well, just start to count your judgments. Just every time a judgment comes up, don't do anything with it. Just go, okay, that's one, okay, two, three, eight, 50, 75, 112. You know, by the end of the day, you're like, this is ridiculous, you know? And literally the reaction most people have is that they start to laugh at their judgments, you know? You start to laugh at the absurdity of the mind that thinks it needs to decide the value of every person and everything and every experience and every thought and every feeling and put a judgment on it. Like, who am I? the royal judge, you know, the supreme judge, say, let's not go there. And to realize how absurd that is to take that role, so that then judging just has a hard time taking hold in that context, right? It's seen clearly for its nature, just that it's just a tendency of mind. Yeah, and we can see more about that. And then the Dharma explains these things very well, you know, explains how, you know, judging happens, that perception and conditioning and karma and all these things come together to create that. It serves a purpose, right? It has a functional purpose in our lives to judge, to discriminate helpful from unhelpful, dangerous from not dangerous, pleasant from unpleasant. It's, you know, judging has a very vital role in our lives. However, when we start to observe it on a meditative level, we see how something like that can take us over and just almost be like an energy suck. You know, like, what do I need to spend my energy on this for, right? You know, I've sort of verged here into judging, but it's just another example of the ways that we can use our practice to free ourselves from our of our habitual tendencies, to see them on these two levels, both on the personal level and see the conditioning behind that, the habits of that, and on the Dharma level. And so that, again, our meditation doesn't become this effort to suppress what's arising, but it becomes an effort to see into what is arising, to understand it, to meet it with wisdom, and further, to meet it with kindness. This is really essential. When we meet fear or judgment with kindness, we immediately take it out of the realm of suffering, really. And the meeting it with kindness helps us then to engage in this process, because when we meet it with judgment, it's hard for us to stay with this process of inquiry. Because the process of inquiry requires us to look at some difficult things. And if we can bring in this attitude of kindness, a lot of times I think of it as just acceptance or allowing. Oh, okay, this is what's happening. We often need that before we can even start the process of looking, because the discomfort and the resistance and the kind of hovering, this isn't supposed to happen, aversion or judgment to it, it kind of makes us resistant to turning and looking at it, because there's this fear, again, about ego, right? If I look at this negative stuff or this painful stuff or this difficult stuff, I'm going to find out that I'm a bad person, for instance, the type of thought that we have, right? So if I just don't look at it, I don't want to look at it and see that. It's a lot like denial in addiction. I just don't want to see it. So if we have this kind of partner of kindness saying, you're okay, I'm going to take care of you, or, just this, for me, it's almost a physical thing. It is partly a physical thing, I will say, not just almost, that a kind of softening my body. People put their hands on their heart, right? And these kind of things when they're working with this. Oh, let me just feel that. Let me just soften so that then I can move into this tender place. It's like having a little bit of Novocaine there before we start the drilling. All right. Well, that's what came to mind. And that's what I will offer you for today. So thank you for your kind attention, and I hope those words are of some value. We have some time left if anyone wants to chime in or ask a question.
Yeah, hey Kevin.
Hi, Mike.
And so this idea of kind of inquiry versus therapy is a really kind of interesting one. And I'm trying to kind of get what you were saying. And I see what you were saying about, you're seeing it, you're letting it go, is kind of the inquiry. But it seems like they're kind of two disjoint ways of looking at it. Like the therapy one would be, more like fourth through ninth step kind of attitude, right? Where you're drilling down and you're trying to see more detail and look into responsibilities, where I think what you're saying during the meditation is like, what were you calling it? Dharma lens, like a more kindness, more, you know, try to see it, maybe see it at a higher level of what might be causing it and not get stuck in it. I mean, is that a fair way to say it back?
Yeah, I think so. I think, I mean, I don't want to, I'm not really suggesting that, like, that these have to be, that we shouldn't do all of that stuff, right? That we shouldn't also have sometimes a therapeutic sort of approach to our meditation. You know, that's sometimes what we need. And I think more, maybe more importantly, I think the lines between these things are pretty blurry. There aren't distinct differences necessarily, you know, because I think that the 12 steps are also pointing to a not self insight. You know, when in the traditions where it says, you know, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, every mind needs to place principles before personalities, that's saying the same thing in different language, you know, that principles before personalities is dharma before self, right? And I always felt that the very personal excavation of inventory and sharing in meetings led to a sense of seeing yourself as just another human being, rather than it, even though it's very personal and individual, that it reveals the universality of suffering and the universality of harm that we each do. So what was freeing to me about doing inventory was realizing I'm not alone with that. So again, like a not self revelation comes through that. I don't know if most people understand that in the 12-step world explicitly, but I certainly think that's what's happening. When someone shares their story in a meeting, the whole point of it is that we're all going to relate to that, right? The reason we relate to it is because it's not individual. And we relate to the universality of it, which is the not self aspect of it. I don't know. I've kind of gone off maybe from what you're asking, but yeah.
Yeah, no, thanks, Kevin. And I agree. It's like a real, it's kind of a gray area, but I get what you're saying about trying to not get too investigative, you know, during your meditation.
Well, and again, like, not to take your experience too personally. I mean, that's kind of what we're getting at here. Like, oh, there's my stuff. Okay, it's my stuff, but underneath it, it's just stuff. No, and that's where the letting go really happens, right? Yeah.
Paul here.
Who is that? What? Oh, Paul.
This is Paul.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Hi. Yeah. Hi.
Yeah, it's on the same thing. The psychotherapy and the inquiry. You know, I think normally it comes to mind for therapy that there's an action, sort of a fixing, and in meditation, we're often instructed not to. But again, to echo what you both said, is that there's maybe a blurry line there, in that for me, sometimes there are things that I'm, with the inquiry, I'm just seeing and reminding myself of something I've already been aware of. And so therapy, or the action part of it, just happens because I've noticed it. And then there's other inquiries where right. it might be something new or a situation or an aspect or behavior or even a thought pattern that's arising that's new to me. And that will take some work beyond that. But are we there just for that moment to do just that? And that's the inquiry and that's the investigation. That's the, in a way, step four and step 10 on the ongoing basis. Even when we're not off, even when we're off the pillow and we walk away from an interaction, you know, I'm often asking myself, what did I do? What was there? What did I understand or think I understood? So yeah, I just thought it was interesting anyway to touch in on how sometimes those, just knowing, just the inquiry creates the therapy that sort of, maybe because it's been visited again. Anyway, sort of just stream of consciousness, thinking along with exploring this idea.
Yeah, yeah, good. Thank you, Paul. And you know what, for some reason, something you said, you know, as we do, I'm like thinking, having my own thoughts while you're talking. One of the things that we also need to be careful of is that we don't turn this kind of inquiry or like looking through the Dharma lens into spiritual bypassing, in which we just go like, well, there's no self anyway, you know, so we don't deal with our shit, you know, like I don't have to deal with my personal shit because there is no self. So that's great. I solved that problem, you know. I can be a total asshole, and it's just like, oh no, I'm not, you know, that's no asshole self, you know, it's just, it's all empty, you know? So the, you know, the personal responsibility part, which of course is what the 12 steps are pointing to, because 4 through 9, you know, starts with looking into my own stuff and ends with, oh, I guess I better take responsibility for it on a social level, not just on an internal level. You know, I'll write it for myself, then I'll share it with one person, but eventually I get to, okay, I've got to, like, you know, be open and honest about this failing. So
yeah, thank you. And is it in 3, am I remembering right, that it's free of bondage of myself? So maybe it actually starts in there by letting go of oneself. We can then go to step 4, right, and look within.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how much I think Buddhist philosophy you can find in the 12 steps in the big book, from that to the selfless, you know, and to loving kindness, like around page 57, I think it is, and other things that are definitely, you could see that, or I've been told that there's much, you know, exploration of other religions and philosophies when Bill was writing the book back in the days.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Paul. Monica.
Well, I'm just curious, great topic. Joseph Campbell reminds us that it's to non-identify, and it's also Tara Brach, you know, recognize, analyze, you know. But how do you balance that? I mean, I know that as an addict, I would probably be looking for a loophole if I hadn't done the steps first before right. I started. But
yeah,
if in Buddhist thought, it's non-identification. I mean, how do we resolve? Because obviously I did those things. But do I say a person experiences things, these things? You know, I mean, I guess I'm kind of going around on this topic.
No, I mean, you can't. It's not helpful to get attached to not self any more than it's helpful to be attached to self, you know, it's just because it's just a concept. And, you know, both of those viewpoints have a value, and the wisdom is knowing when to apply which one. You know, delusion is going, oh, there's no self, so I don't have to be responsible, right? But delusion is also, oh, it's all my fault, I'm a terrible person, and, you know, I just need to be unhappy because I deserve it, you know, kind of thing, you know. So we try to hold them in some kind of skillful balance, which takes, you know, practice, as they say. But I mean, further, you know, this is why we keep practicing, because we have to keep looking at these things and sort of seeing both, you know, how they work and how they individually, how they work and how they work together. And excuse me, and I would say that certainly when we start out in this kind of practice, we have to work more on the Dharma side than on the self side, because, you know, that's been our whole existence, our life has been like caught up in the idea of the self. And so we really have to cultivate our wisdom side. Everything is impermanence, everything is empty, you know, all those things, until we have enough clarity about them that we can sort of see them both and then gain some balance between how we relate to them. But it's not, and that's also not to say, oh, you're going to get to a point where you're like, you have perfect clarity and then you always know when to. No, I mean, that's just, you know, we just do our best.
That first time I met you many, many, many years ago, now feels like, but there was at least one person in the room that was trying to bypass the step. And you did say you should get that down good before you, you know, start extending into the Dharma. So that stuck with me. I mean, I already done the stuff like 3 or 4 times at that point. But
yeah. I mean, I don't know if you need to do the steps before you get involved in the Dharma. I mean, we can't, you know, it's not a matter of sort of, but definitely there's some things that the steps point to that are not emphasized that much in the Buddhist world and that can easily turn into spiritual bypass, which is a great term. And if you don't know what it is, I recommend Googling it and studying it. It's definitely worth understanding. So we're past the 11 a.m. here in the Pacific time zone. So I will let you guys go for the day. I appreciate people showing up. I know you don't come here as a gift to me, but it sometimes feels like that. So I enjoy it. Thank you. And I'm going to be in Alaska on Friday. Wow, John. Oh yeah, John, you're in Beirut. I'm going to be in Alaska on Friday, so I won't, I'm going to let Debbie, I have asked Debbie, she has kindly agreed to teach the class on Friday night. So you'll be in safe hands, as they say. And so I should be back on Tuesday, assuming that I don't get eaten by a bear. I don't think there's a lot of bears in Anchorage, but you never know. So, oh, there are bears in Anchorage, Eleanor. I better watch out. All right, I'll stay indoors. That was my intention anyway. All right, folks, have a good day and keep practicing. Swallowed by a whale. All right.
Thank you, Kevin.
All right, you guys. Thanks.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks. Thank you. Safe voyage.
Thanks.
Thanks, Kevin. See you.
Thanks, Kevin. Bye-bye. Safe journey.
Thanks, Angela.
Thanks.